Welcome to In Search of the New Compassionate Male. My name is Clay Boykin. I support this podcast through my coaching practice. I help people visualize and harmonize, find direction and meaning, or simply get unstuck. Contact me at clayboykin.com for a free consultation. Now here's the latest episode of In Search of the New Compassionate Male.
Hello world, it's me, Dennis, and here we are again on In Search of the New Compassionate Male. I'm the co-host of this particular podcast, and I'm here with the founder and host, Clay Boykin. Hello, Clay.
Hi, Dennis. We have Connie Baxter Marlowe and Andrew Cameron Bailey for round two. Last episode 106, we talked about trust frequency, the trust frequency. Mm-hmm. And today, one thing I learned was that Andrew has done quite a bit of work, men's work in years past. And then there's quite a bit of work that Connie's done that's related to men's work specifically. And since we're here raising compassion consciousness with men, I'm really excited about our conversation. So I want to start off and let's get to it. Andrew.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, you started doing men's work. Take it back as far as you want. I'd love to hear about it.
Let's go back to, 1990. Mm-hmm. I actually started doing my personal men's work by joining the women's movement in 1973, I think it was, in Manhattan.
Really?
And I didn't know that. I didn't know that it was going to be relevant. I was one of the few males admitted into some fairly inner circles in the downtown Manhattan radical feminist movement because my girlfriend was a leader in that field. So as the decades went on, I said, man, that really taught me a lot. Taught me a lot about dealing with women, which is different from the subject of the compassionate male, but I think it's relevant. The men's movement, here's John Lee, here's Melodoma Somme, here's Robert Bly. Here are these extraordinary men coming out with these books and then leading these workshops. And I was busy raising five kids at the time throughout the 80s. And I was really in the midst in the year 1990. And there was a call. I was living in the Hamptons, in Quogue or East Quogue in the Hamptons, which is close to Southampton. And there was a call for a meeting in Sag Harbor. Now, I don't know if you know these towns at all. Sag Harbor is one
absolutely.
Of the sweetest little towns in the world, really, and in America in particular. And there was a meeting. And I said, I'm gonna go check this out. This is interesting. Like the men are coming up, the men are emerging. Let's see what we can do here. So I attended this meeting, and are you aware of the Sterling Group?
I'm not either.
You're not? Okay. Thank God for that. Because this meeting was called by a group of men who call themselves the Sterling Group, and there's a person named Sterling. I'd never heard of these people either. Walked into this meeting, about 40 men showed up, and I knew most of them. I was part of this community out there, right? I was in the construction business. I was in the consciousness realm. I was in the creative arts. I had a band and stuff like that. So I knew at least half, if not two-thirds, of these men. And it was a hard sell. There were, I called them five mustaches. There were a row of these five mustaches on the stage. They looked like they came out of a Queen music video. And they sell. So this is my introduction to the men's movement. So very weird one. And finally, it's like, okay, who's signing up for the weekend? $500 the weekend. And
now this is $500 when? In
this is what you had to pay to go to this.
I know.
1994.
All
right. So $500 in 1994 is about $2,500 today.
So purchasing power. Here's a guy raising five kids, working really hard. Didn't have that kind of money, but also I'm very resistant to hard sell. So the question, there's a silence in the room. Then one guy puts up his hand. He said, I'm going. Really good friend of mine, actually the lead guitarist in my band, puts his hand up and said, I'm going. And then it's like, they're really trying to get, I'm realizing I'm at a sales pitch. So, okay. Nobody answered. So I put my hand up and I said, you know, I'm sorry, but I won't be going. A, I don't have the money. B, this is not quite the angle I'm interested in, but as there are 40 or 50 men in this room, I'd like you guys around here to know that if you're interested in forming a men's group, I'm up for that. And one of the mustaches said, I don't like what you're doing. I said, it's okay. I'm leaving. I'm out of here in a second. I have one thing to say. And I said, you know my number. Give me a call if this is interesting to you. I'd like to start something that doesn't cost money, is not part of a movement. It's simply a group of men getting together to see where it takes us. And the guy's yelling at me. And I said, it's okay. Good night. Thank you. And I left and I drove my 40 miles home and got home and my phone started ringing and didn't stop ringing. So that's how it started. So we had a next meeting with about six or seven men. So this is this question of a men's movement, a men's meeting, a men's group. What the hell does that mean? What could it mean? It could mean a whole lot of different things. So we had a meeting with about six or seven men who called me, and we, within a week or 10 days, we're sitting together in a room and going like, okay, this is interesting. Let's get some parameters here. Question number one, how many men? And we tossed around and we agreed upon 10. Let's have a group of 10. Should be handleable with 10. Too much smaller, it won't be that relevant. Too much bigger, kind of hard to handle. 10 men. That 10 men, those 10 slots were filled within another 3 or 4 days of that meeting. Full, sorry, bang. But my phone didn't stop ringing. And I'm like, sorry, we're full. What do you mean you're full? Sorry. So guess what this poor guy ends up having to do? Start another one. So on every Monday night, we had a men's meeting of the one group and the other group, because another 10 men immediately came into focus. And I was sort of the commonplace because it was my phone that was ringing. So, and then the question is, okay, now what are we going to do with these meetings? And we came up with, okay, we're going to have 2 hours. We're going to have there for a very short amount of time each. Someone's going to have to be a timekeeper. Let's get really disciplined and careful with this. And let's have some real rules. No chit-chat. Make it serious. No crosstalk. Talking stick. While you're on, you're on. And what are we going to talk about? Whatever's uppermost in your mind. Okay, so that I like that. It could be the fight I just had with my wife, or it could be a painting that I'm struggling with, or it could be a trouble at work, or it could be, damn, I saw this girl on the street, you know, and wow, whatever it turned out to be, right? So we did that all of the 1990s.
Well, now let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Why did they not go to that first group that was courting you to join for $500 for the weekend? Why did they not do that? And why? What did attracted them to what you were offering?
You know, we never even discussed that.
Really?
The only man I know who joined that group is my son.
That group, meaning the first group you're talking
about? The Sterling group. My son, decades later, my son at that time was probably 7 years old, 8 years old. He later was trying to get me to join this exciting thing he had discovered. And I said, tell me about it. I said, it's not called Sterling, is it? He said, yes, it is. I'm like, okay. So it's a big success. It's a big deal. It's many millions of dollars. And it's very pushy. And if we three men were doing this together, we'd be getting really macho with each other. We'd be pushing each, shoving each other physically around to show how masculine and male we are. That's not what we did.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Because this is what I've run into. That there's a whole number of men's groups out there. And for guys to be in a men's group, first of all, I think is great. They're different levels of their consciousness. So different forms of men's group work for different guys. So, yes. But what I have learned is that some of those men's groups are trying to break into the guy to get him into his heart. But there's a whole population of men out there who are already in their heart. and they need to learn how to connect with another man. They need a safe place to go to. And I'm just curious, does that kind of relate to your experience and what you were doing?
Yes, without getting too specific.
Okay.
Let me ask you, Clay, a quick question. Do you ever go to the Mentone meeting?
The Mankind Project?
No, the Mentone in Alabama?
No.
Okay. I don't know if it's still going. It was an annual meeting but I only went once. It was with Robert Bly.
Okay.
Martin Prechtel, remember mm-hmm. him?
Mm-hmm.
John Lee. It was mm-hmm. spectacular, about 130 men, and it was great. So mm-hmm. somehow the group of men who came together to that meeting was sort of compatible with what we were working on. Okay. Now, I have to say, that was not the most satisfying men's experience I've ever had. In fact, within a few years, I was just thinking like, oh, man, you know, I don't want to listen to these guys talking about how many times they screwed their wife last night or how many times they've had an affair, how many times they've been unfaithful this year. I don't care about that. How many times they jerked off. I really don't care. And that kind of stuff was discussed no, thank you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And secondly, I really wanted it to be spiritual and challenging. And the best thing we did together was go on trips, go on camping trips, and we'd mm-hmm. go camp. I had some land in upstate New York in Woodstock, and we'd go camp on my land, for example. We did a bunch of different things. And we'd sit there, and one of the interesting things I had, by that time, two of the men in the group were really good musicians, and we ended up forming a band. We had this band all through the 1990s, as well as this men's group, and so they were sort of integrated. We're on the land, and I said something, and I can't remember what it was, but one of the men, Connie knows him, in my band jumped up across this clearing and came at me, almost got physical. He got completely outrageously pissed off physical with me I don't know. I offended these guys. So there were a couple of them there, the bisexual ones, strangely enough. I somehow managed to offend them, but not because of anything to do with sexuality. It was more to do with the things in my life that have been exciting and that I want to talk about, sometimes have to do with people whose name you would know. And it was assumed that I was making this shit up, that I was lying, that I was puffing myself up. And sorry, these are actually people I've worked with and they're my friends. You know, so it was not that good. And eventually what happened, there was a coup within this group about 7 or 8 or 9 years in. And one of the members of my band broke up the band and the men's group in the same evening. They kicked out four of us. The guy who poured for the sweats, this muscular, tattooed, amazing, the man of our men, the greatest poets, like the poet laureate of New York, kicked him out. Another guy who is a very significant therapist, and me, the four of us. They said, we're terminating the group, goodbye. And then a week later, it turned out that the other five, one had dropped out, so there were another five. Those five had some waiting guys in them, and they reformed the group, and without a hiccup, off they went. And my phone started ringing again. And it was like, wait a minute, this was supposed to be for life. The poet said, this was meant to be our insurance policy for the rest of our lives. It was meant to be our support system, so we'd have this group of men we could totally trust for life, no bullshit. And what's going on? I said, can you come over to my place? I've got my little recording studio. Let's sit there. So the four of us sat down and we said, guess what, guys? We are the rejects. We're out. And I'm personally really relieved. I'm really glad.
Okay. So
how about that? It wasn't personal. It wasn't
right.
Me. Yep.
It was something about the
dynamic,
the nature of the group. So, yeah.
What I'm going to guess here.
Mm.
You wanted to go deeper spiritually or metaphysically, and they
were afraid to go that deep, to really go into their heart. Is that what was going on?
I think they would, in other words, there was sort of an A group now and a B group. Mm-hmm. The B group just got kicked out. Mm-hmm. The A group would totally disagree with you. There was sort of a status thing or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Whatever it was, I probably by 95 or so, 96, I was going like, okay, I've just to myself, I never really brought it out, I don't think. I did my woman's work back in the 70s. I did my men's work in the 90s. Now I want to do the men's and women's work. I would like to see a group. Let's have 12 people,
mm-hmm.
6 women, 6 men, not couples.
Mm-hmm.
And to really, really get deep. Never did it. Haven't done it yet. Not saying it won't
mm-hmm.
happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say one more thing about the second group, which was a lot more peaceful and less contentious. And I'm actually closer to more people in that second group than I am in the first group. That group also continues to this day. Mm-hmm. And when I met Connie, I said to the man, I said, you know, and then you're about my divorce and all that stuff. And I said, would you even consider having me bring this woman to one of our meetings? I think she has something to say to us. And I invited Connie to the meeting. It's the only time we did it. But man, that was the most wonderful men's meeting I've ever had, where we had Connie. Connie, mm-hmm. you want to talk about that?
Well, do you guys have any thoughts you want to talk to Andrew about?
No, well, we want to talk with you about, because you're here with 3 men who are really working to both to get to their hearts and to expand compassion. And so you can give us some perspective and give us some of your thoughts, please, Connie.
Well, I'd be happy to. Because I've been waiting for decades for this very moment. Well, I'm serious. Well,
here it is.
Here it is. Thank you for inviting me on your Seeking the Compassionate New Male. Because I have an incredible resonance for the tender male heart. And I would say that perhaps I'm more balanced to my masculine. Andrew's more balanced to his feminine. He's way more intuitive than I, way more in touch with his body. So this whole dichotomy of what's meat suit we're in just makes no sense to me. What's going on right now, that the women are going to lead us, the men have all screwed it all up, and the women get out of the way, men. I mean, that's a travesty.
It's a pendulum, pendulum swing.
It's a travesty. And we're not doing pendulums anymore. We're at the fulcrum now. We're going up into unitive consciousness, into the open heart. How are we going to open the heart of the male when we're telling him to get out of the way, that he's just messed everything up? It makes no sense. Look at the men who've done incredible and continue to do incredible work in the open heart arena of compassion and kindness, and I mean, they're leaders. I'm sorry.
but that is, Connie, that's the difference between binary thinking and being able to hold 2 thoughts at the same time. We can see the extraordinary gifts that men have brought to the table, and at the same time also see the limitations. We can bring them both to the table. We don't have to have one in order to reject the other. We don't have to reject the men in order to accept the women. This is an all-in.
Exactly. And I feel that we've been responding to a lower frequency on the planet. Everyone has, the women as well as the men. So we've all been doing nasty stuff to each other. It's as my son said, it's been a mutual wounding, mm-hmm. because I feel the male heart is so tender that it's been wounded by our child-rearing practices and by the women in its life, okay, in their lives, okay? So that's my thesis, is that we just don't know the true male. We have the armored heart of the male that steps out after a couple of years, by two or three, he's learned that he's not supposed to cry. He's not supposed to play with dolls. He's not supposed to play house. You know, he's supposed to play with trucks and guns and all that. You know, it's crazy for me. And so when I had a boy, I had my third child was a boy. And I was thrilled to be having a boy. And I did everything in my effort, in my realm, to raise a compassionate male, a true male. And so when he said at age 7, "Mom, my feelings tell me I don't belong in school," I, because of the trust frequency, absolute walking in the trust frequency for me, I didn't have the word risk in my vocabulary. You can't when you have your son's life in your hands. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Okay, honey, Obi-Wan Kenobi says, trust your feelings, Luke. I guess you don't have to go to school anymore."
And he was how old?
7.
Oh, my gosh.
First grade drop. This
a first grade dropout.
You are with the mother of a first grade dropout right here. And wait till you hear about this first grade dropout, what he's doing right now, this moment.
Oh,
right.
My goodness.
Okay. Yeah, but let me say that, see, I had been spending time with visionary Native elders for many years. And I saw through them that we each came with a gift and that it's a loving universe. This is what our trust frequency book is all about, to give people the tools to be able to walk in absolute trust. I knew that the universe was going to chase Johnny Marlowe around with a silver platter with every experience he needed to become the gift he promised to bring to the world. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have the word risk in my vocabulary. I couldn't, with my son's life in my hands. But I set him free. I didn't pull him out of school because of my beliefs. I didn't interfere with my children's destiny paths in any way. We swooped and darted and did extraordinary stuff. But I followed their lead. I didn't lead them, because their soul knows what their soul's destiny is. People would say, "How can you let a little boy like that make that kind of a decision?" I said, "I don't live in there. It's not my destiny path. It's his." And so I set him free. And my husband I was kind of the leader in the child rearing scene. And he didn't understand me anyway from the time I had my spiritual awakening. And so I set Johnny free. I let him go. And he didn't resonate to learning to read. He didn't resonate to any of the academic stuff. So I just let him go. And I know that we have an ability to access information much faster than reading. Okay, so I didn't care if he learned how to read or not. And his father had been turned off to learning to read by his father, who had demanded that he learn to read. We are so neurotic about teaching our kids how to read. And if we understand the human spirit, that we actually have to do the opposite of what we're told to do, or at least that's my spirit. Anybody tried to tell me what to do, I make sure I do the opposite. So I set him free. And ultimately, because it's a loving universe, a man showed up on our doorstep to teach Johnny how to read. So I said, "Okay, universe." So he came and he was Johnny's tutor. Johnny's a voracious reader, an amazing writer. And as Andrew's pointed out, he's now a flourishing photographer in Los Angeles. He's 36 years old.
And I've known him since he was 17, man. And he's my hero. He really has turned out differently than his peers. His college buddies are in depression or drug addiction and God knows what, and he is not. Very interesting. What's the difference? There's a difference somehow.
There's a difference because we have an educational system that does not honor the human heart and the human spirit. So I went to bat for the human heart and human spirit in Aspen, Colorado, to change the educational system and bring the heart and bring Native American thinking into our ponderings about, okay, how are we going to, what sort of educational system are we going to have that's going to take the human race to our actualizing our true potential as loving beings in balance with all of creation? So that's been my experience since the exact same time that Andrew's speaking of. This was 1994. His son and my son are the same age. And so Johnny was seven. And what happened, though, it was January of his first grade year, and the teacher called everybody together, all the kids together, and she said, well, this is Johnny Marlowe's last day in school. And a little girl raised her hand, and she said, but Johnny, how are you going to get a job?
First grade. First grade,
little girl, no less.
She knew exactly what the program was.
She knew what she was in school for, to tell the teacher what the teacher wants to hear, or you're not going to survive. This is called survival.
Exactly.
Okay? You know, get a job, support your family, survive, have food on the table. 7 years old, this little girl, no less. So this is the arena of the trust frequency to teach us, to give us tools for walking in trust, going into a higher frequency where the laws are expanded. It's a completely different ball game, because I want to tell you what happened for Johnny's life was magical. The people who showed up in Johnny's life, Johnny becoming, he was just flown out to New York with a team of 30 people to do this shoot in New York City from Los Angeles. He's just turned 36 like last week. And so he's flourishing. He just bought his own home with his earnings as a photographer.
No help from parents or anybody.
And he got the girl in Aspen and stuff like that. And so when Johnny decided that he wanted to go to school, we swooped and darted the system. Actually, somebody from an alternative school said, well, Johnny, anytime you want to come by the school, just feel free, because his sister had transferred to that school. So Johnny had the freedom to go and be a part of a system without being a part of it.
Right.
And so he was able to be socialized and stuff like that. And so when he decided he wanted to go to school, when the student is ready, the teacher will come.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolute. It's a loving universe. Okay. That's what the trust frequency book is all about. Johnny is the trust frequency poster child, because he said, I want to go to school. So a companion tutor showed up for him and came and brought him up to speed academically so he could go to school. And this guy was from outside of the paradigm as well. So I just want to say that when you tell the universe what's up for you, the universe must comply. It loves you, okay? But you've got to do it with bold, committed action. And that's where this trust frequency set of assumptions about the nature of the universe helps us understand how loved we are, that it gives us everything we ask for. What are our requests? Where we put our attention? What our assumptions are? Our seven A's of our consciousness. So, and mainly that's bold, committed action.
It is. I find that when I'm getting to that trust place, to be able to trust, to be able to step out that, to be able to step out and trust, are there little steps to doing that, or is it just all or nothing?
That's a great question.
Oh, guess what, Dennis? It's all or nothing.
Boots and all.
I mean,
yeah, you can't do it in a half-assed way, I think is the answer, right?
Yeah, doubt, you can't do it, because it's frequency, it's vibration, it's physics. There's no judgment. It's not.
Well, all I'm saying is this, is that if I am tuning in to a frequency on, let's say, an FM radio dial. Remember those old dials where you would turn in?
This is
it. And you would start to get, and you begin to get some of the signal, and you get some of the signal, and then you get clearer and clearer on that.
So it is a practice. I'd say it's the rare human who's able to just grok this, get it in one microsecond and say, oops, that was then, this is now, and now I'm enlightened, now I'm here.
Right.
I'm in a state of total trust. I doubt that happens very often. But it's about testing these assumptions. For example, if you take those 10 assumptions that we proposed last week and you just try it on, but you have to try it on, really, you have to be brave enough to, it's like trying on a
Absolutely.
Suit, brave enough to, you know, go to work and wearing that suit or going to the opera or whatever it is. You have to try it on 100%. It's almost like, I think there's a relationship to, let's say you decide to become a Buddhist. You went and you saw a Buddhist teacher and some of your friends really had got into it and you went, you can't do that in a half-assed way. You really have to take the plunge to, if you're constantly hedging your bets. My son, my rock star son, when he was about 12, he said, Dad, I'm going to be a rock star. I'm going to be a musician. I said, you sure? He said, yeah. I said, good, do that. He said, what about college? I said, if you feel it, do it. But if you don't, that's okay. You could have a plan B. But if you have a plan B, if you have a fallback position, you'll probably fall back. So that kid right now, last I heard of, was in Miami recording with the Wailers, the Bob Marley's Wailers. He made that commitment. He thrashed, that's a term we used to use in South Africa. He thrashed school. He took the prize when he graduated from high school in languages, mostly in French and Spanish. Mm-hmm. He was like the languages guy. And then he went off into the CD, he didn't go to college. Now, his older sister did go to college. So that was her path. She did that. She's a big deal lawyer right now. That was her path. She did that. And all, yeah, I have five kids, and they're each radically different, each from the other. Now, we're all raised with the same basic principles. And I thought Connie's story of raising her kids in this really alternative way, I really thought that was what I was going to do. When I came to this country, it was at the time, it was in the 60s, the student rebellions. Kids were not happy with what colleges and schools were doing to them, and they were rebelling. And I was very interested in that field. I don't know if you've heard of Summerhill. It was an experimental school in England. It was the time of those experimental schools. How can we completely, can the Waldorf system, all these different ways of alternative ways of teaching our kids. I thought, I'm absolutely going to raise my kids. I'm going to have a whole bunch of kids and I'm going to raise them in a completely alternative manner. I was wrong, because when it came to do it, we were living in the Hamptons. There were alternative schools that were really expensive. There was no way we could do five kids. And the kids were thriving in the system.
Yeah, his kids
are. So again,
right.
They really thrived within the system and then emerged. And we were hippies and not even Americans. So the kids got a lot of flack at the beginning. By the beginning of high school, those kids were each being challenged by their schoolmates and put down. And your parents are just stupid hippies and organic vegetarians. What the hell is that? Etc. And by halfway along, things began to change. And by the end of school, everybody else wanted to be like them. They honestly were like the leaders, each of them in their own way, were leaders. Now, when my musician son shows up, those kids from school are his biggest fans in front of their stage.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I wasn't a hippie, okay? I was private school, New England, old family, Mayflower descendant. My ancestors started colleges, Bowdoin College, et cetera. And
yeah.
But I say I was sitting on top of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? You know, the triangle.
Sure.
I was sitting up here on top. And I have a responsibility, and that's one thing these schools, New England's women's schools, teach you is,
of course,
with privilege, responsibility. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I was sitting up here waving, hey, how do you do? I had the power to let my son drop out of school.
The freedom, yeah.
The freedom to do that, even though my parents disagreed and my sister was going to report me to social services, whatever it was, I didn't care because I came with a job to do. And that is raise humans that are going to contribute to society, number one. Number two, shift the consciousness of humanity. I mean, we're big picture thinkers, right? So we've got a big job to do. And so I could listen to my children's hearts, listen to their spirits, and follow those impulses for them. Open the doors. That was my job, to open the door for their destiny path. So one daughter, instead of going to college, went off to China, was smuggled into Tibet, and et cetera. She ultimately put herself through college, and she's now in Amsterdam. Now,
is she?
Well, yeah, for a Fortune 500 company that she, because she got an MBA and all that. And my other daughter, she had her destiny path as a rider and as a this and that, a horseback rider. And she's now supporting her family in Aspen, Colorado with my granddaughter and her husband. But each one has their own destiny path. We can't be channeling them into this educational system that says, you know, if you get this on this test, you're okay. And if you don't on that test, you're not. And, you know, your trajectory, et cetera. You have to have the courage and the trust to walk in freedom, because we can do that individually. It doesn't matter what the rest of the culture is doing. If your vibration is up, you do anything, because the rules that apply to you, like Henry David Thoreau said, the laws that apply to you will be expanded, or new laws will be made in your favor, and you will live with the license of a higher order of beings. That's in his conclusion to Walden. I quoted that last time. But that's when you walk confidently in the direction of your dreams. So it's just up to us to give people the courage to go there. And as Andrew said, it is a process. For me, it's like absolute. So I'm not really one to speak, because it hasn't been a process for me. Fear was never one of my things. And, you know, I just came in for a different ride. But it is a process, like Andrew says.
What I'm hearing is that each of you have created an environment for a young person to develop, let's call it solar energy and their lunar energy. You know, traditionally the solar, you know, leads, you know, that's traditionally the male energy, and the lunar, the woman, the female energy. But we all have both. And what I'm getting from this conversation is that you allowed whatever that was, wherever they were, to find its own space, to not to be forced. You're a guy, so you got to follow this path. You're a woman, you got to go this way, but to find themselves along here. And I know y'all gave them guidance along the way, but you were kind of tapping this side and letting them find and develop their heart as well as their head. And then integrating and finding their own equilibrium within that integration. If I could turn the clock back, boy.
but would I have listened?
For me.
I understand that. But one of the things that I missed, that I feel like I missed when I was growing up, was that I went very much, I looked up at, in the 50s, I looked up at adults as a child and went, they really don't know what they're doing. They really don't know what's going on. So I'm going to take this myself. I'm not going to really listen to what they said. I'm just going to, and the challenge with that is that I never learned as a child what value there could be in hard work, what value there could be in delayed gratification. I didn't get that. I didn't get the chance, you know, like Clay, when you do that beautiful mandala behind you, to be able to have that sense of being able to do a piece and work on it and build it. If I didn't get that instantaneous gratification, so therefore it took me a while before I got, until I was in my 30s, that I began to see that experience of being able to. And I always felt that if I could have had someone that could have sat with me and helped and modeled for me and helped me to go to what the value of that delayed gratification. So that's the learning that I'm getting now that I did not get as a child, that I just dismissed.
Dennis, guess what? It's your soul's journey. Everything has been perfect.
I agree.
Our soul journey. There's no what if and if only. There's
I do not believe.
Okay, here I am, world, and I've got this work to do and get that work done because the earth is moving into a higher frequency. We got to get that shadow work done, that less than, not okay, and oh, if only, and what if, etc.
I don't go there, Connie. I really don't. I am so appreciative of everything that got me here today.
Yeah.
Sweet. That's important.
So, Dennis, you're bringing up for me the idea of the mentor, of the wise elder in the village, you know, where a young woman or a young man has an elder to go and just sit with and learn from. Maybe learn a trade or learn a technique or talk about spiritual matters or talk about leadership or talk about marriage or childbirth, whatever the subject might be. Right. And it's something that I think we lack, that we've lost as sort of white Westerners in particular. I think the Native Americans have more of that still to this day, despite everything that they have struggled through. They've kept certain things. Connie and I believe she'd agree, we get a lot of inspiration from our indigenous friends. There's something there in the non-white, non-Western world that has real value that the white Westerners, tended to denigrate that too. Like, you don't have a religion, you're not very bright, you're primitive and all of those things. And I'm so delighted that we now live in a time when we have woken up. I think it started back in the 60s. It maybe started earlier.
I do too.
But in the 60s, where we suddenly started paying attention to the Native Americans in this country, for example, going and sitting in a peyote ceremony in a teepee, those kinds of extraordinary experiences that are missing. So if my kids, I know one complaint my kids had about me, or at least my middle boy, and that's that I didn't give him enough hand-holding support. I trusted him too much. I gave them very clear, they had a strong mom who was great. And what I gave them was the instruction that you are free. However, with freedom comes self-discipline. Think about that to my boys. Yep. Think about that. You are responsible for the results of your actions. So if you go down a path, and my youngest boy nearly did, one of his best friends just died just a month ago of a heroin overdose. I mean, there was heroin in that Hamptons community kids were getting into drugs. Kids were getting into breaking into places to get money to buy drugs. There were those kinds of things going on. And of all of my kids, only my one son went to the edge of that. And we saw that. We had an idea. And we knew a local cop, a policeman. And we called him and we said, look, I think our son's maybe getting to hang out with the wrong people. And long story short, a week later, son comes home from school, walks in the living room, there's a uniformed officer there. And we just introduced them and left. That did the job.
Interesting. I want to ask a question. Because you're touching around a subject that keeps coming up in my mind. And first of all, I think that we've got a population, the Western civilization, that we have a population of a lot of adult children. They've not gone through the ritual change from childhood to adulthood. I'm going to say it's initiation. Mm-hmm. Now, initiation is a loaded term because it brings up a lot of misplaced activity that it's gotten a bad rap. Mm-hmm. And so initiation, when I ask people about it, or initiation or rite of passage, well, what was it? Oh, when I got my driver's license. No. Yesterday you were a boy, and today you're a man, and you take on the mantle of a man, you can still live what's in your heart to live. But there's never been that not never, I can't say that, but less and less there is that demarcation point. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
So let me just say this. I grew up in Africa. Okay, at the age of 3, I was transplanted from England, where I was born, to South Africa, and grew up in the midst of a culture, specifically the Zulu people, mm-hmm. who have very strong age groups.
Yes,
they have these initiations at different ages, and the boys and the girls, but I know more about the boys, and the boys will have a circumcision.
Yep.
At puberty, for example, which is a painful, dangerous thing.
Yes.
And they would go through this together as a group. Nelson Mandela went through this. He spoke about that. I ended up getting a degree in social anthropology because I realized I'm a science guy, but I realized I was actually more interested in human beings and our potential than I necessarily was in physics or math or chemistry, you know, which were my fields before that. So those cultures have very specific systems of mentorship, absolutely rigid age group initiations. When you reach a certain age, such and such happens. When you're a little boy, you're looking after the chickens. Later on, you're looking after the goats. Later on, you're with the cows.
Right.
And later on, you're out hunting the lion, and then you're allowed to marry. And none of those things can happen before a certain time and before you've passed the test, as it were.
Right. Right. And
so
much of that's
so radically different from our culture.
Right. And I witnessed this in Kenya when I was there. I saw it on the news. A woman newscaster was saying, this season we will have initiation ceremonies for 20,000 young boys, and all the hospitals and all the support systems are in place for this. And what I learned was that, yeah, they're publicly circumcised, and if they flinch, they bring shame on their parents. Now, in that culture, for that time, in that tradition, you know, I don't judge it. But there's something between that extreme and nothing.
Right.
And unfortunately, we're swinging towards this nothing. And so we've got a bunch of adult children running around. And unfortunately, they're in politics, they're leading corporations, et cetera, et cetera.
And they were raised by women, by the way, because most of us men in this culture have to go to work. And so I was...
Right.
If you spoke to the mother of my children, she'd probably say, you were an absentee father. And mm-hmm. I said, yes. Because I had to go to the city and work and bring home the bacon and bring home the money. And mom was very responsible for how the kids, including the boys, were raised.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd just like to say something. Yeah. Because I always bemoaned the fact that I wasn't part of a culture that had tradition. Okay, so what you're saying. And then this grandmother... A native grandmother came into my life and she said, yeah, tradition's over. I was told not to bring all my ceremonial implements out here to Colorado mm-hmm. with me because it's over. It's a prison. And it's, you know, you have to do this at a certain time. You have to do that and right. blah, blah, blah. You know, so she, and this was in the 90s.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just important to, one thing, recognize that each culture, each color of man has a role to play in the evolution of consciousness and the evolution of the cosmos, because everything we do affects the cosmos.
Absolutely.
And they're proving this in science now, that the human heart and our emotions and everything, actually, we're the same energy. Is all mm-hmm. of the cosmos. So we're in process, and this is from the eagle's perspective, from native perspective, the high visionary elder perspective, that every race has had a job to do in this process.
Well, and that's a whole another realm to get into.
Right.
And it's a it's a tough one to talk about. Especially, I mean, Dennis, you know, you and I,
of course,
have been, and that's been on the show before. And so I get that, but I tell you what, here's what I think I've learned it with Will and Cynthia at the Gender Equity and Reconciliation, mm-hmm. that we're all wounded.
Yeah.
There you go. Mutual wounding.
That yep. regardless, every one of us is wounded. We're wounded through patriarchy, through however it is. And that's our common ground. And if I can look at you, Connie, and say, you're a wounded soul, you know, and I had people look at me and say, well, Clay, you've got everything going for you. You're a privileged white Western male. Well, I'm wounded too, you know. And here's this, not comparing wounds, but that's our common ground. And if we can look at each other beyond the surface and recognize that suffering we both share, then maybe there's hope at this higher level of consciousness. Dennis?
I completely agree, because that's what I get into that comparison mode. And that's where I want to, because I believe that we can. This is where the whole piece of that comes in, Connie, about white shaming and how this works. I don't believe that's the process at all. We each have to carry our own responsibility for who we are and how we behave today. And be able to, you know, and I cannot know what it's like to be a woman. I cannot know what it's like to gestate a child, but I can be your ally. I can be your ally and make sure that your rights are protected and do the best that I can to be able to do that. I can't know another person's, but I can be your ally. I can be your ally, and I can also walk in my own perspective, in my own truth, to be able to up-level my consciousness on each and every day, whether I'm sitting in a meditative chair or whether or not I'm going and helping someone across the street. I have both of those things to do. That is my work to do.
I want to pick up on that, Dennis, because I want to go back to, Connie, something that you said early on about how you grew up in Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And it's incredible to me, you know, yeah, you say I was at the top and that's how your family was. And look at what your family brought for the greater good.
Absolutely. You know, they were philanthropists. They gave away the family fortune to the people of Maine in the form of parks and mountains and everything.
That's right.
The giveaway was huge for them.
That's right, because
that's part of the deal of really understanding what is enough. And also, I love what you said about returning those to whom a lot has been given, a lot is expected, mm-hmm. and they returned back to the process. And that's one of my great quests, is to ask people, what is enough? What would be enough? And it doesn't matter what your number is. Would you know it when you got there? Does Jeff Bezos know when he gets there? When he, you know, okay, I have enough. That's all I need. And do we actually ask ourselves that question in the Western world? What is enough?
Well, fear and scarcity. Sorry, Clay.
But go ahead,
fear
please.
And scarcity. Our whole system is based on the problem of scarcity, mm-hmm. our whole economic system, okay? So when there's scarcity, there's fear, will there be enough tomorrow? So then we start hoarding, okay? So in the trust frequency and in native way, the giveaway is huge. And in my family, the giveaway. Okay.
Because that's circulation. That things circulate in our body. What things circulate in the universe? Why would they not circulate here? Why would that one place no longer be a law?
Yeah, and it's again, it's vibration, it's frequency. So when you're in that higher frequency, there's more abundance than you can fathom. Jesus with the loaves and the fishes, etc. John Lennon with Imagine, you know, they're telling us, they're showing us there's something, there's another ball game. Yeah. And we were in a lower frequency of scarcity and separation. And so that and fear. So yeah. That's what created these systems that we've responded to and played ball with.
Right.
In order to survive.
Right.
That little girl, seven-year-old girl. How are you going to get a job, Johnny, if you don't go to first grade?
And we just...
Fishes has a problem, and that is, what are you going to do with 40 bushels of leftovers?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the problem. The problem is so much abundance that you can't believe it.
Well, you're so right. And, I mean, we barely even scratched the surface of this whole topic.
In the men's
work, you know, I mean, we touched into that. There's so much more, and it's such a dynamic time for men, for young men, and for the second half of lifers.
Absolutely.
It's just it's an incredible time of change. And I'm heartened because I hear more and more and more of men's work that's being done that is heart-centered.
So really important, what you're doing.
And really healing. And,
yes,
and,
so important.
You know, I feel like it's so wonderful. So, Dennis, back to you.
Well, I am just so grateful. I'm so grateful that we get an opportunity, Andrew and Connie, to be able to continue the conversations about all of our vibrations and how we are bringing more compassion onto the planet, because compassion has to be part of this vibrational frequency too. I mean, it has to be part of who we are. And that's what we are in search of. And that's what we're in search of without and within, as we said on the other broadcast. And I'm so grateful that you would gift us with another hour of your time, and another hour of the graceful. All the links for everyone who's watching or listening will be on the webpage. And we look forward to continuing conversations. And also, we might even be able to meet some of your family and have a little bit of this intergenerational conversation along the way.
I'd be willing to ask my boys if they'd come on.
Good. I'd love to be able to do it. Anyway, thank you, Clay, for inviting me along the journey of in search of the new compassionate male. And Connie and Andrew, thank you so much for giving us this time today. And it will not be long before we will see everyone again. And thank you so much for joining us in search of the new compassionate male. We'll see you next time.
Check out the latest episode of In Search of the New Compassionate Male on your favorite podcast station.